Australia calling. Hello, America. Australia calls you to hear Mr. Walter Gladfield, President of the American
The ABC Social History Unit presents the final program in the series, Bright Sparks, Australian Radio Stories, compiled by Stephen Rapling.
In the early 1920s, while public attention focused on the new broadcasting stations, wireless experimenters, including the Marconi Company, started exploring short waves. Shortwave communication was seen as a way of reducing Australia's isolation from the rest of the world, especially Great Britain. The special attraction of radio links was that, unlike cables, they couldn't be easily cut by an enemy in wartime. One of the first engineers at AWA to explore the high frequencies of shortwave radio was Sidney Newman.
In March 1924, my employer, AWA, sent me to Mr. Fish, later Sir Ernest, home at Vaucluse, with a second station at Willoughby, to listen for shortwave transmissions on 92 metres, being sent from the Marconi experimental station at Poldhu, England. And to our astonishment, we successfully received the signals. It was on the 10th of November 1924 that we sent the first Morse signals from this country to England. And in April 1925, I was given the job of developing and installing a shortwave transmitter and receiver on the steamship Niagara, with duplicate equipment at Pennant Hills radio station, which proved so successful with daily Morse signals on the voyage to Vancouver and back that it created worldwide interest.
Short waves were attractive because they covered a greater distance at less cost. Early in 1927, AWA launched the high-speed radio telegraph service called the Beam Wireless System. In September that year, 2FC organised the first Empire broadcast over AWA's experimental shortwave station, VK2ME, at Pennant Hills near Sydney. Gwen Gibson from 2FC.
Of all the programmes that were most exciting that I was associated with, it was the first world broadcast, carried out by 2FC in conjunction with AWA and relayed by the BBC. We went on duty at 9 o'clock on Sunday night, 2:30 on Monday morning, artists and staff sang with great gusto, Advance Australia Fair. And we had a beam message back to say we were being successfully received. Prime Minister Bruce spoke from Dandenong, the concert programme proceeded, and we finished up at 5:30.
The reception in London was very good. The whole programme was rebroadcast by the BBC, and press reports were most enthusiastic. For instance, the Morning Post considered, quote, it was one of the most remarkable experiments in the history of broadcasting.
Eric Burberry. There were four more Empire broadcasts before the end of the year. And all this was 5 years before the British began their own Empire service.
This is London calling. London calling the Australasian zone through GSD. GSD. 11,750 kilocycle, 25...
AWA's shortwave stations continued their test broadcasts. Radio historian Philip Jeeves was a broadcaster at Sydney station VK2ME in the early 30s.
We used to operate it from Sydney using one of 2CH's studios. The transmitter was at Pennant Hills. It operated on 31.28 metres... It was a very high-powered transmitter, and it went out to the world. It was the voice of Australia in those days, and it was the equivalent, at that time, of what Radio Australia is today. And various announcers, trusted ones only, I might say, were given the opportunity of running the programmes on VK2ME, and also, and this was very rewarding, reading the mail that eventually came in from people in all countries. And you got a sense of the enormous power of radio. and its ability to communicate with people in far distant places.
By the end of the 1930s, listeners worldwide had become fascinated with shortwave broadcasters. There was a particular interest in the strong signals from the German propaganda stations. A month after the Second World War began, John Curtin described Australia as the silent Susie of the Pacific. He argued the case for Australian broadcasts in Japanese, Dutch, Chinese and other languages to refute enemy propaganda. By the 20th of December 1939, Australia was on the air.
This is the first shortwave national broadcast conducted by the Australian government. I am speaking to you as Prime Minister of Australia. Our reason for establishing broadcasts of this kind may be quite simply stated. In brief, we have decided that over some of the propaganda stations to which you listen, so many strange things are said, not only about Australia, but about the whole of the British Empire, that the time has come to speak for ourselves.
Yes, I was the controller of the Overseas Broadcasting Service from January or February 1940 until, I think, the end of April 1944.
William McMahon Ball, former ABC commentator.
A war was on. And however much you may deplore it, we were largely a propaganda service. We were trying to tell the world what a wonderful country Australia was, what a wonderful pride we had in lining up, first of all, with the United Kingdom, and of course, with the outbreak of the Pacific War, lining up with the United States, how proud we were of our allies, what wonderful allies they were, how they stood for freedom, civilization, and everything else, and how very unpleasant the enemy countries were. We tried, and with some success, I think, to avoid the crudest types of propaganda, the crudest types that indulged in trying to distinguish between races and speaking of the Japanese as an inferior race. We did everything in our power to avoid that kind of thing. But undoubtedly, our news commentaries and our talks were propaganda. They were strongly biased in favour of the Allies against the enemy.
The listening post was literally one room. We had three knobs to turn to get alternative programs, two or three programs on the landlines, and one typewriter and some headphones, and that was it.
Helen Ferber was one of the first to work at the Australian Shortwave Listening Post in Melbourne. Their job was to monitor broadcasts from enemy countries. Finding out what the other side was claiming about the war was the first step in preparing our own broadcasts.
Of course, you've got to remember that in those days there were no tape recorders and no satellites, and when you listened, you nine times out of ten got terrible static and was struggling to hear, you know, what was being said behind the static. We did most of our listening in the evening and overnight because the reception was better. But it was quite hard making the rosters, which was a job which fell to me, because you had to use your scarce resources of, for instance, interpreters for the Asian languages to cover the most important broadcasts from Japan and other places occupied by the Japanese. And then you had to match your European languages to the best times for receiving from Berlin or Rome or somewhere like that.
As well as gathering material for the programmers of the shortwave service, the monitors at the listening post were also hunting for more strategic information.
There were a couple of broadcasts from Berlin Radio which were beamed to this area. In other words, they were not stuff that would be picked up by listening posts in Britain or Delhi or the United States. And it was very important for us to get those. One was a news broadcast, and it was no doubt intended for people on merchant raiders and things like that. Another was messages to seamen. And we had to get those verbatim because they wanted, you know, the services wanted to analyse them. And so the only recording means in the early stages was to cut a 78 RPM acetate record. And, of course, when you played it back,
You turned the machine off, it ground to a halt, you typed up that sentence, then you turned it on and had to find your blooming place and so forth. It was a ghastly procedure. I have to tell a joke about myself. My very first week at the Listening Post, I was told, go up to the ABC, which was in on Russell Street, and they'll make this tape, this recording for you, and you transcribe it up there on their machines. And they made the tape, and they put it on the playback, and I sat down, and it went... So I solemnly went out and said to the ABC technician, you've given me the Japanese one, not the German one. It turned out I'd got it on the wrong speed. But after that, I learned my lesson, and I quickly, after Japan came in the war, could distinguish Japanese from almost anything. They tried to make out that Australia was the orphan of the Pacific, and they emphasized our dependence on the United States and called us the 49th state of the Union, there being only 48 at that stage instead of the present 50. I don't think the Germans presupposed a great listening public in Australia, and the Japanese probably wouldn't have had any listeners at all, given the very few shortwave sets there were in the country and the very bad reception most of the time, the dreadful static. But they got the idea, which had been used by the Germans in World War I, of including broadcasts of letters or messengers from our prisoners of war in their hands in broadcast so as to induce people to listen. And they were very successful. There were something like 30,000 Australians in Japanese hands, and their relatives had no news of them whatever. Didn't know whether they'd been sunk or killed or whether they were prisoners. So, of course, as soon as the Japanese started these prisoner of war messages, the word got around, and people came flocking to the Listening Post. They'd heard about the Listening Post. What can you tell us about these broadcasts? Well, we, of course, were monitoring them very carefully. We were using our precious Edison wax cylinders to record them. We were noting them as we recorded them in case they didn't record perfectly. And we were passing the messages on, as instructed, to the military services, because only they could check the names and the service numbers of the people involved. So we weren't allowed to give these messages to the poor people who came to us. And that meant that they started, you know, buying short waves, clubbing together to buy short wave sets. And some people whose relative was in prison and was a prisoner and was broadcast would get telephone calls and letters from all over Australia from people who'd heard the broadcast and said, you know, we heard this from your husband, from your son, from your brother. So they were getting these garbled reports, and it was very hard to get the names right, sometimes because of the static.
After a bureaucratic battle, the names of POWs broadcast by the Japanese were eventually passed on to relatives.
Sometimes the Japanese even interlarded something themselves, and we could identify that fairly readily because they did things like refer to Nippon and the Nipponese, which no Australian would have used. They'd have said the Japs and Japan. But one letter that was broadcast was from the late Rowan Rivette, who was an Australian journalist, to his then wife. And he went on and on about the beautiful tropical surroundings and so forth. And then he said, truly, this is a land where every prospect pleases. And, of course, to judge by the pleased tone with which the Japanese announcer gave this message, it was clear he thought this was a great compliment. But, of course, most Australians would know that I think it's a line from a hymn, ended, where every prospect pleases and only man is vile. And, of course, the Japanese didn't know that. And they were very pleased at the compliment, you know.
On to victory! September 1938.
Munich. Germany, the United Kingdom.
Hedy Hurst worked at the listening post. She'd left Austria in 1938.
When I came here, I had no passport, of course, because I had lost my Austrian nationality. And the police regarded me as an enemy alien. And so, as an enemy alien, and war broke out, we were not allowed to leave Auburn, this where I lived in South Hawthorne, East Hawthorne, without permission. We needed a permission even to visit people in Camberwell. And when I went to the for my job, I got a permission to go to Essendon because that was the place of my work. And my husband got permission to go to town because that's where he worked. And the funny thing, of course, was when I worked on highly classified material and confidential material and so on that wasn't given to the press or anybody, I still was an enemy alien and had to get permission from the Auburn police station to go to Collins Street to listen to that material.
So it was a Friday afternoon when McMahon Ball called me into his office and said, would you put up a notice on the board saying any mention of enemy naval activity in Australian waters to be reported at once to Commander Long? And McMahon Ball said to me, now, this is not to be put in the notice, but what has happened is that a German merchant raider has sunk a Sydney off the coast of Western Australia. And he said, we don't know whether the survivors on the Cormoran, which was then sunk by the Sydney, were able to radio before they were shipwrecked to Germany. They hadn't admitted anything. So I went back and I put the notice on any naval movements, etc., to be reported to Commander Long, and I kept a tight lip about the rest. But it was a Friday, and a number of us were going for a holiday up near Healesville just for the weekend. And my mother had a bit of her petrol ration left, which was a great treat, and she said she'd take one carload. So we were driving along Friday night, and Mum says, wasn't that awful, Mac, about the Sydney? And Mac looked daggers at me, had I gone straight from swearing secrecy and rung my mum with the story. But he just said, oh, what was that? And Mum said, oh, didn't you know she was sunk off the coast of Western Australia with all hands? Merchant raider. And McMahon Ball said, where did you hear that? And she said, oh, I was at a lunch of naval wives today. And she said, they were all terribly distressed because, of course, they knew the wives of the captain and the officer and all of them were lost. So much for security. It's a terrible story to tell, but it was true.
This is the Australian Broadcasting Commission's field unit with the AIF. The Brook has been relieved. It has now passed into the category of history.
They call us the Rats of the Brook, but we can still sing, and here's our opening number. Bless them all.
Cheer up, my Rats of the Brook.
When the troop ships are heading back for good old Aussie, and we march down Martin Place in our victory parade. Yes, I can see the scene now. There'll be the Prime Minister, the Minister for the Army, and all the other big shots. And the Minister for the Army will say, now, Mr. Prime Minister, here's the 6th Division from Libya and Greece. And here's the 7th Division from Syria. And here's the 8th Division who went to Malaya. And the Armored Division. And all the militia boys. And the Prime Minister will say, but didn't we have a 9th Division? The Army Minister will say, hell yes, I forgot. They're still in Tobruk.
While the shortwave service broadcast Australia's view of the war to the rest of the world, the ABC's field recording unit brought the war back home. Len Edwards was one of the engineers recording the war correspondents' reports directly onto acetate discs. The discs were sped back to Australia to be broadcast.
Some of the discs were 16 inches in diameter. They're fairly big discs, and the equipment was very, very heavy. The first equipment we had was it weighed about 400 pounds, and this was quite impossible to cart around in the field.
Yeah.
You had to depend on all sorts of different modes of transport and other people to help all the time. But the gear was very, very heavy, and it was very, very bulky. The first equipment we took out was, it was about 2 feet square, cubed in an amplifier, and the same thing in the disc cutting equipment. And then there was the 12-volt accumulators and the power inverters, which converted the battery power up to the 240 volts AC to run the equipment. So it was all very, very heavy and cumbersome and almost impossible to cart around unless you had proper transport. But transport was another thing, of course. We had to have motor transport or native carriers or somebody to help all the time. And this was very inhibiting as far as getting into places where you could really do good recordings. And it was very inhibiting from the point of view of getting into forward areas where you could really get actuality recordings. And that was the object of the thing, of course, to get actuality recordings.
Hello, BBC.
This is Chester Wilmot speaking at 30 seconds to 9 o'clock on the evening of March the 23rd. In 30 seconds from now, Buffalo's carrying the assaulting troops will begin to cross the Rhine. The Rhine is now dark.
One in particular was when we had to carry it. We had to carry it in behind a tank that was going forward. And you'd creep up behind this tank, shelter behind the tank, and then when the tank took off, you'd have to duck into a shell hole. And so we ducked into a shell hole and set up this gear. And then, I don't know whether we got seen or not, but anyhow, a few mortars started dropping around, and that was when the equipment got shrapnel in it, and that finished that one.
Bill McFarlane worked with the first field recording unit with correspondents like Chester Wilmot.
Quite often, if you went into an artillery area, you might be able to bring your vehicle up, and you might have to carry it in under cover of darkness, so you'd have to sort of stumble along as best you could and then set up, you see, and Chester invariably wanted to go wherever the action was. So, and if that was right up forward, well, that was where you had to operate. In those days, it didn't worry me at all because I was relatively young, and it was never a problem.
This is the Australian Broadcasting Commission's field unit with the AIF in Greece. When the Germans drove through into the plain round Salonika, Australian troops were holding an important pass which led southwards from Salonika. Through this pass, there was only one road, but over it, Greek and Allied forces, which had been operating in the plain, were withdrawn to stronger positions in the mountains. Behind them, but in front of the Germans, the road was to be blown up. Our sound truck, manned by Chester Wilmot and Bill McFarlane, waited all day long with the engineers who were to do the blowing up, and in the recording they made, you will hear the story of the day's incidents recorded on the spot. The engineers did a good job. In fact, they did so well that when the charge went off, the explosion blew us off the air. The truck shook and the cutting head lifted. And so you won't hear the noise of the actual explosion, but only the sound of hundreds of tons of earth crashing to the bottom of the gully. And now, here is the story of blowing the road. Holding up this pass most of the day, there's been a fairly chill wind, and as a matter of fact, it's so cold that the soft acetate discs on which we make these recordings virtually froze up. And when we first started to make a recording, the discs were too hard for the sapphire to cut them. And the result has been that for the last half hour, our engineer, Bill McFarlane, has been hugging a disc to his chest with my greatcoat over the disc and trying his best to get it warm. There may be some background noise in this disc, but if it is, you'll know that it's because the weather here has made these discs a little colder than they should be.
Well, we've had to wait rather longer than we anticipated for the blowing up of this part of the road because they had to wait till the last of the Greek artillery got through. It's now midnight and it's absolutely dead quiet in the valley. Saying that it was absolutely dead quiet in the valley, but since then things have been disturbed a little. As you heard, there was rather a vast commotion, and rather earlier than we anticipated, the whole caboose went up, and there was rocks flying everywhere all around us, and as a matter of fact, they landed so near that we had to run for the shelter of the bank.
Battles, of course, are very difficult things to record because they're spread over large areas usually, and you'd only get one very small section of it. You get plenty of background noise, of course, but that doesn't mean anything. And very little. But you could also get comments of the people who were in the actual area at the time. That was okay. Or you could get the sound of aircraft dive bombers and the bombs coming in and exploding, that sort of thing. Those things were no problem, but it's very difficult to get what you'd call a battle. You'd only get small sections.
And here now is a recording which we've made of the post when it's actually in action.
£400 of gear was just impossible. So I managed to convince the ABC in Sydney that we wanted lighter gear, and they did a lot. They shopped around quite a lot, and I shopped around quite a lot, looking for lightweight gear, but there was nothing. So they sort of financed the building of this thing, and I hired a private workshop in Sydney, and I went to town. I built this thing.
And you actually did the cutting?
Built the whole works.
The lathe and all?
Yeah, the whole works. The whole works, including the amplifier and the gear. And that gear was a tenth of the weight. It only weighed 40 pounds. And you could carry it in one hand. Yeah. And it had all the discs, or a number of discs, in the lid. Everything was compact. It ran off dry batteries. And that made the whole thing very mobile. So we were able to get around quite a bit and get into places where we could never get before.
Len Edwards' lightweight disc-cutting machine was used for the last 18 months of the war, another bright spark from the Australian radio industry. Whether they invented new techniques or adapted ideas for the wide variety of rugged Australian conditions, radio enthusiasts made a major contribution to the industry in its first few decades.
In Australia Calling, the final program in the series Bright Sparks, you heard Sydney Newman, Gwen Gibson, Eric Burberry, Philip Jeeves, William McMahon Ball, Helen Ferber, Hedy Hurst, Len Edwards and Bill McFarlane. The wartime reports from Chester Wilmont and the shortwave broadcast recordings of Robert Menzies are from the ABC Radio Archives. Special thanks to Jean Walker and Susie O'Brien of Radio Archives for their help with the series, and to the other people who gave us access to their collections. And thanks to Tony Baldwin, Alison White, Noel MacDonald and Ken Short. Music for the series was written and performed by Kathy Peters. Production of Bright Sparks, Sharon Davis, Peter McLeod and Stephen Rapley for the ABC's Social History Unit.